Thank you very much, Matt, for reading for us there. When I was putting together the titles for this series, I was trying to think of something that people love or they hate, hence Marmite being the title for this evening. But as I reflected, Marmite doesn't quite cut it in the way that I wanted to think tonight. You see, there are very few things in life that really polarize opinion, that you love or you hate. But the thing about Marmite is that you can avoid it if you want to. Instead, I think that a much better way of thinking about this question of Jesus and his identity is about caravans. You see, caravans are the best illustration that I can think of, because everyone is, in one way or another, affected by caravans. You're driving slowly down the road, you're going on holiday. Why? Because there's a caravan in front. The way you react to a caravan, though, is going to depend very much on where you are in relation to said caravan. Have a look at this picture up on the screen. You see, your relationship with caravans, love them or hate them, basically depends on whether you are in front of the caravan, and it's going to be your opportunity to enjoy your holiday, or if you're stuck in that traffic jam behind the caravan. And the response often is actually quite strong. So if you really find that you're hating caravans, which I think some people do, but I'm not interested in your reaction to that. If you find that you're in that position, you might call for them to be banned on the road. So I was reading this week about somebody in Devon who owns a haulage firm, and he was saying that caravans ought to be banned in the summer months between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. on the roads in Devon. Or alternatively, if you really, really, really want to get rid of caravans because they're that much of an inconvenience, then maybe you might find yourself going to this length. Twice. Owen clearly doesn't like caravans. You see, when we think about caravans and the like, some things polarize opinion, don't they? And in our passage, that's exactly what happens with Jesus. Have a look. Chapter 3, page 1010, if you've still got your Bibles with you, if you have it open there at page 1010. Have a look at verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him, that is Jesus. Or verse 7, Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed him. It seems that there's a love-hate thing going on. Some people want to destroy Jesus. Some people are flocking towards him. They love him or they hate him. Now, for some of us, this might come as a bit of a surprise, because my guess is that in our modern culture, our modern context, Jesus often doesn't provoke that kind of response. I think it's because in some ways we've watered down Jesus a little bit. We've secularized him. We've thought of Jesus as the nice guy, the cuddly guy with a beard, who would probably be your mate if you turned up to the pub and saw him in there. You find people wandering around with slogans on their t-shirts saying things like, don't do drugs, give Jesus a hug. Or maybe we think of the kind of South Park image of Jesus as someone who's just really ineffective, ineffectual, wet, perhaps. You see, I think our modern world has sanitized Jesus, watered him down. We've made him an example to follow, a nice guy to look up to, a good leader amongst many. He was one of those people who was all about love. And who can disagree with that? That's kind of how people find Jesus these days. He's one of those people who we've molded so much that he doesn't actually challenge our perceptions or the way we live our lives. But if this is true, if that's actually the case about Jesus, then the question must be, why did people want to murder him? And actually, why did a whole crowd of people call with one voice for his execution 2,000 years ago? Because I don't think they would be doing the same thing to the Jesus that we portray these days. Why? Well, I think actually we need to engage with that question. We need to get to grips with the real Jesus as he is presented by Mark in his gospel. And that's what we're going to be doing this term. Thinking, who is this man? So if you're new to Christian things or you're looking into Christian things, this is a great series to come along to. Because if you want to know what it is to be a Christian and to live as a Christian, Christianity is all about following Jesus. You need to know about Jesus Christ. Or perhaps you've got friends who are interested in Christianity. Bring them along so they can hear more about the real Jesus. And so, we're going to be doing that this evening as we look at this episode in Mark chapter 3. We join the story, verse 1 of Mark chapter 3. Jesus has entered the synagogue. People are gathering there, it's the Sabbath, and Jesus is there as well. The religious leaders are hanging around, and a man was there, verse 1, with a withered hand. A man was there with a withered hand. Now, in order to work out what's about to happen, we kind of need to do a bit of back work to understand what's going on. So when we hear the word Sabbath, there might be a whole range of different things, different ideas that get conjured up in your minds, depending upon your experience of church in the past or otherwise. But when we hear the word Sabbath, it's referring back right to the start of the world, so when God created everything. In Genesis 1, it says that God made everything in 6 days. And then Genesis 1 verse 31, it says this, God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God rested. And God finished his work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. At the seventh day, if you like, the Sabbath. Sabbath literally means seven or seventh. So the seventh day was a day of rest. God rested not because he was tired, not because he was exhausted after 6 days of creation. You might think that would be legitimate, but it's not the case. He didn't need to rest. But actually, the rest of the Sabbath is all about enjoying relating to God. Adam and Eve were made to enjoy being in that relationship with God, in that place where there was no pain and no suffering, where there was wholeness, fulfillment, and God was there. That's what the Sabbath is all about. It's all about rest, enjoying life with God. And that was the blueprint for creation. That's actually why, I guess, if you ask people what they want from their lives, you find that our hopes and our dreams are often very similar to that. We want a place where there is no pain, no suffering, where we're not struggling and toiling, where there's no death. We're left thinking, actually, this is not the place that it should be. We don't want life to be like this. Our hope is for a better world. A world of peace. A world of wholeness. That's the world we're created for. And I guess almost everybody universally hopes for that. I'm guessing all of us probably in this room hope for something along those lines. And I guess all of us want to be a part of making the world a better place as well. The Sabbath was to be a once a week experience of that kind of peace and wholeness. Now have a look at the end of chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 27. That's what Jesus is saying. Chapter 2, verse 27. Jesus said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." The Sabbath wasn't there to test God's people, but actually an opportunity to enjoy God's blessing, His presence, His peace. And so when Jesus says, "I'm Lord of the Sabbath," He's saying, "I'm the one who brings blessing, peace, wholeness, fulfillment. The things that all of us are created to desire and to want." So, this is the background for the Sabbath. But in the Ten Commandments, it says this: "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day." Or alternatively, later on in Deuteronomy, in the Ten Commandments again, it says, "You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So if I was going to paraphrase the Ten Commandments, I would probably do it something along these lines. God says, one day a week, rest. Everyone, rest. You don't have to work because I'll provide for you. You used to be slaves and I rescued you. So rest. Because you're not slaves anymore and you can rest. I'm your God. I'll look after you. I'll restore you. I'll heal you. I'll refresh you. And the Sabbath day is a great time to remember all that I've done for you. So take a weight off your feet and rest. But the religious people in this passage, they're called the Pharisees. The religious people in this passage took the Ten Commandments and they twisted what was a blessing of God and they made it into something they had to achieve. In a Pharisee's house, it might have sounded something like this: "Levi, no, you can't make me a cup of tea. You need to put your feet up. God told us to rest. God told us to sit down. And no, you mustn't go and play outside in the garden. That's far too energetic. Sit down. Do what God commanded you to do." Do you see the difference? The difference is that one group takes the blessing of God and enjoys it. The other group thinks, actually, I need to work to achieve that rest. God's going to be checking up on me. God's going to be making sure that I do what He's commanded me to do. And so rather than coming to Jesus, the person who offers peace and rest, these religious people, the crazy thing, the Sabbath became not a thing to enjoy, but a rule to observe. And that's actually what religion does. Religion takes something about freedom and turns it into slavery. It takes something about rest and turns it into work. It takes something about joy and turns it into misery. So let's rejoin the story here in chapter 3. Jesus is there in the synagogue. And in there is a man with a withered hand. Verse 2. The Pharisees watched Jesus to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath. Well, it would seem reasonable, wouldn't it, for Jesus to heal on the Sabbath? The Sabbath is all about restoration. It's all about healing. It's all about wholeness, enjoyment, fulfillment. But actually, they want to see if he heals the man because they want to accuse him. They want to say, well, is Jesus going to break our rule? Is he a rule breaker or a rule keeper? They hope that Jesus will heal the man. Not because they like the man, they have compassion on him, but actually because they want to accuse Jesus. Religion suddenly turns into something that destroys rather than healing. But Jesus sees it coming, doesn't he? Have a look at verse 4. The man, verse 3, the man, he says, come here. And he said to the Pharisees, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to kill? Jesus throws the question back at them. And can they answer? No, they can't. They're silent. Which is better, to break your rules and do something good, or keep the rules? That's the question. And actually, that's a pretty difficult question for them, isn't it? It means that actually they're thinking, well, which is more important? That I do something which is, or that we allow Jesus to do something generally good, or that we follow the rules? And we discover actually that their heart is all about themselves and not about others. They couldn't show this man compassion. They would rather leave him in his poor state than break their own rules. They are totally self-centered. They don't care about the man as long as they achieve the I've passed the Sabbath test mark. That is religion. Religion is all about saying, I can do it myself. I'll keep the rules. I'll do it myself. And you know what? I reckon that religion puts a heck of a lot of people off Christianity. Because I think a lot of people assume that that's what Christianity is all about. They assume it's all about keeping the rules, being a good person, being a nice person. I think religion puts people off Christianity. But what does Jesus do? Jesus says, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. I am the one who provides healing, restoration. So what does he do? Verse 5, he says to the man, stretch out your hand. The man stretches it out, and the hand was restored. Jesus did exactly what this guy needed. Jesus says, come to me. I'm here. Now, it might be, though, that even if religion is one of those things that clearly isn't a good thing, we slip into that kind of thinking very easily. Do you ever find yourself thinking, well, I'm a good person, I've done nothing wrong, and that being the thing that you're confident about? I'm better than that person, so God ought to be happy with me. Or maybe actually you find yourself thinking the opposite. I've done so much bad stuff that God could never love me. I'm so hopeless. I must try harder. All these things are signs that we work on the basis of religion. And our world does. My daughter Hannah, I was at her school this week. They were doing like a parents' evening for everybody, and they showed us how the school operates in terms of creating this really great place where sort of relationships are good, people are friendly towards one another. And what they have is, in every classroom, they have a board which has plastic pockets in it. And every plastic pocket has a card in. Each child has their own plastic pocket, and it's got a card in. And you start automatically on a green card. At the start of the week, you're always on a green card. But if you do something bad, then you have to go onto a yellow card. And woe betide if you end up on a red card, because a red card means that you get sent to the headmaster and you have to have a talk to him. But if you're on a yellow card, if you do a few nice things or good things, then you can go back to being on a green card again, and everyone's happy. Now, at the end of the week, this gets better. At the end of the week, if you've been on green for the whole week, then your name goes into a drawer. And if your name gets drawn, then you get to take a photo with you and the school frog, which is a fluffy frog about so high, named Phileas. And there's also a frog's twin sister called Philippa, which I believe are actually the same frog, but don't tell my daughter. You see, in our world, we naturally operate on this idea of, if you do good stuff, then good things happen. If you do bad stuff, then bad things happen. So do good stuff. That's basically how it tends to work. And it sounds reasonable on the face of it. But actually, That kind of healthy society that we're seeking to create will never be created, will never be established by people keeping the rules. Because the rules are inherently, keeping the rules is self-centered. Doesn't sound it, but it is. Let me explain why. When I think about Hannah, and it's really easy because kids aren't very good at hiding their natural characters. So I can observe her character and I can just see it playing out. When we get to adulthood, we're actually a lot better at hiding it than this. Okay, when it comes to Hannah, she is just concerned about whether she is on a green card or not. She doesn't care about anybody else unless they get a yellow card. Because then if they get a yellow card, she can come home and tell mummy and daddy that she's been really, really good and she's still on a green card, but this boy and this boy and this boy and this girl are on a yellow card. So actually what she does is she uses the whole rule-keeping thing as a way of bigging herself up. So she thinks much better about herself. You see, there's a delight when others slip up if we live in a religious world. It gets rid of almost the insecurity of, have I done enough? Because at least I'm better than others. But this is the heart of it. Religion, the religion of works, is just another way of sinning. Because if it's all about me, if it's all about my achievement, then actually, it is all about putting me in the middle. It's sin. That's what sin does. These guys here, these Pharisees, did not care about the good. They cared about themselves. And so, what is it that Jesus gets annoyed with? Just have a look at verse 5. Jesus looks at them with anger. Why is he angry? Is he angry because they've got rules? Why is he angry? Just have a look at verse 5. What's he angry at? It's not a rhetorical question. Someone can answer it if they want to.
Their hearts are hard.
Their hearts are hard. Their hearts are hard. You see, religion isn't the problem. It's a problem. The problem is their hard hearts. Jesus sees their lack of compassion. He looks on them with anger, but he was grieved by their hardness of heart. That is the problem. Hard hearts is a Bible phrase, and I think it's where actually a lot of this tends to get personal for many of us. Hard hearts are hearts that are calloused towards the purposes, the will of God. You can tell a lot by somebody's job by looking at their hands. I reckon that if you were to look, for example, at a surgeon's hands, they're probably quite sort of precise, quite delicate. Generally a pianist's hands, certainly got very long fingers. And what about a builder's hands? Imagine a builder's hands. What do you reckon a builder's hands are going to look like? Or a farmer's hands. I wonder what Chris's hands are like. Do you moisturize regularly, Chris? But you see builder's hands. Hands that are used to doing manual labor, that take knocks, that carry heavy things around with them. They're probably rough. They may have hard skin on the palms, perhaps cracked skin. Because you see, over time, what happens to your hands is that as you take the knocks and as you do the hard work, the skin changes, doesn't it? It gets calloused over time from carrying around those heavy loads or whatever it is. More and more resistant, because that actually helps them with the purpose that they want to achieve. And it's the same with our hearts. In the Old Testament, Pharaoh had a hard heart. You can have a look at the story of Exodus, where Moses kept on asking Pharaoh to let God's people go, but Pharaoh refused to let God's people go and worship him. Pharaoh's heart was hard. I think that over time, hearts that are given to sin, hearts that are aimed at serving ourselves, become increasingly hard. They become increasingly stubborn to the word of God. They're hostile to the purposes of God. Religion is one way of hardening our hearts to the purposes of God, avoiding Jesus, rejecting Jesus, thinking I can do it myself. And where does it end up? Verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against Jesus, how to destroy him. You see, these people had the opportunity to enjoy God's grace, to experience God's generosity, God's compassion for those who need it. But they reject it. And just as the caravan becomes an inconvenience to our purposes of going to that rest place, going on holiday, they want to get rid of it. They want to destroy Jesus, to be free of him. No inconvenience. And so that's what they end up doing in verse 6. Life is easier without a threat of Jesus. And suddenly we see their true colours, don't we? They were keen to make sure they were doing the right thing on the Sabbath. Is it lawful to do good or to harm, to save life or to kill? And they leave the Sabbath and they go and plot to kill Jesus. That's their true colours. But it's interesting, I guess. We started off, didn't we, thinking about the way that our culture has sanitized and is happy with Jesus. We can cope with him. We're not threatened by him. But actually, I guess if we look at the true Jesus, the real Jesus, the Jesus who says, I am the Lord of the Sabbath, the Jesus who says, you cannot be happy without me, the Jesus who says, you need me. Once we start talking about that Jesus, I think we probably find a different response. You see, the religious people didn't like Jesus. The Herodians, verse 6, didn't like Jesus. They weren't religious. They were just people who were out for themselves. They were wrapped up in their self-importance. They wanted to get rid of Jesus as well. Jesus is a threat to the religious and the non-religious. So I guess if you're in conversation with your course mates, or you're perhaps if you're talking in the office canteen or something like that tomorrow, just see how people react when you suggest that Jesus is the only true God, as he claims to be. In your flats, maybe challenge the perception about Jesus and say that he is ruler of all things, and see how people react to that. You see, when all of us realize who Jesus truly is, then he becomes a threat to us. If we have hard hearts, then we will all, given the chance, murder our Maker. If we really want a world without pain, though, if we really want a world relating to God, the only hope is to turn to Jesus. And that's actually what the rest of the passage, much more briefly, is all about. Religion may destroy, but Jesus delivers. The remainder of the passage reminds us of Jesus' response to those who have a tender heart. People who are in hope, who are helpless, in need, seeking Jesus out. Sensitive to the purposes of God. Just have a look back on the opposite column. Chapter 2, verse 17. Jesus says this. When Jesus heard this, he said, those who are well have no need of a physician. That's those who think they're okay. But those who are sick, I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. They heard, people from all over the region heard and had a believing ear. They suddenly discovered that Jesus gave them hope. No doubt they were partly urged to come to him by their own condition, but they knew that Jesus was the only one who could bring healing, restoration, wholeness, fulfillment. A great crowd, it says in verses 7 and 8. All right, if you want to just stick up the next page. I'm a geographer. It says, Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the sea. A great crowd followed from Galilee. Galilee's here. From Judea, which is down here. Jerusalem, there. Idumea is there. Beyond the Jordan, over here. Tyre and Sidon, up there. They came from everywhere. 120 miles Some of them travelled. Distance didn't stop them. They must have had to leave behind all their homes and their belongings to get them. They came with their ailments, they came with their struggles, they came with everything. And the result, Jesus didn't turn them away. He healed them. Jesus is here to call people who are spiritually sick, spiritually broken, those who cannot save themselves. Jesus doesn't say, work harder, try harder, do this, do that. No. He offers healing and wholeness as the Lord of the Sabbath, enacting the Sabbath, bringing healing and restoration, rescue to those who are spiritually imprisoned. He's showing that all we need is Him. That is what we call grace, I guess, in Christian circles. Now, we follow Jesus not because we think we can please Him by what we do, but we follow Jesus because He calls us to follow Him. He provides all that we need. He forgives our sins. And there is no inconvenience like these guys, too great. If you're sitting there thinking, well, this is all really interesting, but can I say, don't let any inconvenience, don't let any distraction get in the way. At the beginning of the talk, we discussed caravans, didn't we? Those people who have caravans, love them. They're like evangelists for caravans. Those people who don't have a caravan really don't love them. They would rather be without them. And I don't really care about your attitude towards caravans tonight. Really don't care. What I care about is your attitude towards Jesus. Is Jesus an inconvenience? Is His demand to be Lord of all actually something that you find awkward or uncomfortable? Is Jesus the one who actually you prefer to live life without, relying on your own efforts to gain favor with God rather than relying on Him? Are you too proud to admit that you need Him to enjoy God's rest as we all want? Or are you, like the Herodians, too independent to accept that Jesus is Lord, that He calls a shot? It may even be, and this is a bit that kind of got me, that you've walked with Jesus for many years, but you've stopped listening to His word. And sin has gradually hardened your hearts. Verse 19, Judas Iscariot, who betrayed Jesus. You see, if we have hard hearts towards Jesus, then we'll want to be rid of Him. But as we saw earlier, there is an alternative. The alternative is to follow Jesus, knowing that if we hope for a better world, He is the only one who can achieve that. He is the only one in whom we can rely, in whom we can trust. He is our only hope for rescue. He is the only one who can deliver us from ourselves. He brings true rest of the Sabbath, wholeness, healing, restoration, forgiveness, relationship with God. If that's what you want, then Jesus is the only person to provide it. And He calls you to follow Him. No cost is too great, no pain too much, no sin too bad, no guilt too consuming for Jesus to deal with. And it may be this evening that He is calling you to turn back to Him. But it may also be that we are continuing to live following Jesus. The encouragement for us all is to keep listening to His word, admitting that His priorities, His purposes are right and good. That's how we have soft hearts. Hearts that are hard are hearts that have stopped listening to God, that are callous towards His purposes. Hearts that are soft, listen to Him. That's what we want, surely. Listening to God, relating to Him, submitting to His will, rather than to our own priorities. That's what we need. We're going to sing a couple of songs. The first one is Amazing Grace. It's not because of what we do that makes God pleased with us, that causes God to Forgive us? No, it's because of the grace of our Lord Jesus, amazing grace that saved a wretch like me. And then secondly, my God is mighty to save. He is mighty to save, and so we live following him. Let's stand and let's sing.